The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, as I think many of you know, mindfulness practice has entered into our culture in a big way. And there's many people who teach mindfulness in settings where it's called secular mindfulness sometimes, without the Buddhism part. And this is a wonderful thing. And I think that one of the wonderful teachings in this kind of secular mindfulness world that's also taught in Buddhism is that it has a lot to do with learning how to be present for the experience that we have in the moment, just to be present for here and now. And so whatever circumstance we're in, we try to bring mindfulness to it and presence. And that mindfulness and presence has hopefully a quality of non-reactivity, where we don't bring a lot of our reactive emotions, being for or against, you know, and angry or blaming or holding on and clinging and preferring. And we don't bring maybe a lot of associations, beliefs, ideas from the past with us, and kind of, you know, as a tidal wave, bring it on top of whatever is happening, and they get complicated relationships to it. But just kind of like, oh, this is what's happening now. It's been oftentimes it becomes a lot simpler, and we could. So I think it's one of the hallmarks is emphasis on a present moment mindfulness, and then we learn how to bring that with us in our lives. In Buddhism, Buddhist practice includes much more than mindfulness. And there's many things to be said about what else Buddhism brings along besides just this present moment awareness. But what I'd like to emphasize today is that Buddhism also refers emphasizes that there's a transformation in our psyche. That there's that the heart, the mind somehow can be transformed or changed. So that it's not just a matter of bringing mindfulness situations, it's also changing ourselves, transforming ourselves into a different kind of person in a certain kind of way, so that we come as a different person into these different situations we find ourselves in. And so I'll give I think is a kind of poignant example of this. Well, first a little anecdote that kind of leads to the point I want to make. A friend of mine who's a Buddhist teacher was friends with a person who had been the president of the American, I don't know what it's called exactly called, but the American Association of Psychology or American Psychotherapy Association. Or something. It's a big organization, you know, maybe a very important one. And so this person was the president of it, was retired. And was invited over, her and her husband, my friend and her husband were invited over to have dinner with this man they'd known for many years. He was getting elderly. And they knocked on his door, and he opened the door. He swung it wide open, and he said to them, "I don't have a clue who you are, but you're very welcome in my house. Please come in." He was getting Alzheimer's or dementia. And so he, even though they had known each other for years and years, he didn't remember them. But his disposition was one of friendliness, openness, acceptance, like, come into my house. So they did, and they had dinner, and I don't know how that's the end of the story that I was told. And so the impression that I have gotten over talking to different people and meeting different people is that, and this is just, you know, I don't want to say this is always the case. I don't know what's always the case with dealing with the mind and all that. But when people start having something like dementia or Alzheimer's, that a lot of the surface functioning of the mind, the surface coping mechanism of the mind, begin to fall away because you don't have energy or time and do for it. And some of the deeper dispositions that a person has begin standing out more clearly. So some people have had a wonderful compensatory surface mind, where they kept a lot of their deep inner angers or sorrows or issues at bay, because they have a kind of coping way of understanding how to be in the world. And when that coping mechanism falls away, then lo and behold, they're finally there with their deep issues in some way. But because their mind is declining, they're kind of just left with it, and then maybe not without the wherewithal to practice with it or work through it. The people who have worked through some of their deeper issues and kind of settled some of them or freed of them or healed some of them, then when their mind declines, they're not left with the grief or the anger or these other things. They're left with something deeper that's more welcome into my house. I don't know who you are, but so nice to see you. There's a whole other way, disposition of how to be. So as I said, I don't know if this is, you know, the best, you know, I don't want to generalize too much from this idea, but I was trying to use this idea to make this point that Buddhism focuses on a transformation inside. And part of that inner transformation is, in fact, on one hand, is to let go or bring to an end certain dispositions that are not so healthy to have. So the dispositions that we might have towards hostility is a key one that Buddhism focuses on. The disposition towards greed or lust, and you know all the variations that can have, is what considered to be one of the deeper dispositions that Buddhism talks about uprooting or bringing to an end. And the third one that Buddhism emphasizes is one called delusion, and that can somehow come to an end. So that there is a shift, an inner change and shift in practice. So it's not just a matter of knowing how to bring mindfulness and have stronger and stronger mindfulness to our situation, but there's also an inner shift. And that inner shift, then, I said, on one hand, it's off, you know, some things come to an end. On the other hand, it's certain things then have a chance to shine. When there's a lot of greed or lust, when there's a lot of hate and hostility, there's no room or very little room for generosity. It's very little room for love in a beautiful, you know, in a spiritual way maybe, or non-lustful way. And when there's a lot of delusion, there's not a lot of room for wisdom. As these other things begin to fall away, then it seems that for many people, the positive virtues and attributes, dispositions, have a chance to come and grow and develop. Also, these can, not only can they arise just because there's space for them, but also in practice they can be emphasized and encouraged. So they become not just qualities that we do, because that's just the doing of it sometimes is not very deep, but the becoming of it is deeper, where we strengthen certain dispositions of how we are, becoming not someone who does generosity, but someone who is a generous person. Not someone who does kindness, but someone who's become a kind person. And so what we're looking for in Buddhism is not just mindfulness in the moment and non-reactivity, but we're looking also towards what it would take to have some deep inner shift go on, so we can enter the world from a different disposition, a different kind of way, that is more enduring and has value. It's very important, because who knows when your mindfulness is not going to be strong enough to handle a situation that you're in. And I've known people who have gone into situations where their mindfulness wasn't available to them. They practiced for years and years, and somehow the situation was too difficult. They had illnesses, for example, or they were facing surgery, or sometimes when people get older and there is the mental decline, the practice is not available the usual ways that we think of it. And I've known people who got kind of distressed because their practice is what kept them kind of safe, or kept them going, or kept them somehow, kept things at bay, or, you know. And so suddenly they were left without the strength of their practice, and they were, you know, but they hadn't really changed deeply inside. So these are two aspects, I think, very general aspects of Buddhism the tremendous importance on mindfulness and non-reactive mindfulness, and that practice itself is not independent of the transformation. It's actually one of the important ways to allow that transformation to happen. But there's also, Buddhism has emphasizes a lot of other things that we do. And so it's not just waiting for the accident of personal transformation. It's not just like, you know, wishful thinking, if I just do this mindfulness long enough that something will happen. But it's also being interested in this whole area of our inner life and our inner dispositions and how we are, and considering what are the healthy and appropriate ways of supporting a transformation to go from what in Buddhism is called the unwholesome dispositions to the wholesome ones' dispositions. And so in Buddhism classically, there's a whole, you know, combination of different practices that are represented by the Eightfold Path that are supposed to kind of address all of who we are, not just the part that has to do with mindfulness, but also to orient yourself a little bit towards using mindfulness, not just to be present to life moment by moment as it is, you know, like to see the sunset and how nice to be present and fully present for the sunset and isn't this great and wonderful and I can be, you know, now and then go home and eat your lunch and just be mindful of your lunch. It's so good. I can taste these flavors. The food is so good. This mindfulness is so fantastic. I just love it because it's just everything, the flavors explode in my mouth. And this, now I know what the Buddha must have meant by the power of mindfulness. You know, the point is not just to have, you know, greater flavors as we eat. some people are oriented towards their mindfulness to kind of have that kind of pleasure in life. But there is a kind of way in which there is a preference, in a sense, in the practice, to orient ourselves to become more sensitive, to use the mindfulness at over the quality of our inner life. What are our dispositions? What are our mental, emotional tendencies? What is this emotional life? What are the motivations that drive us? And to become more aware of them and mindful of them, and then to be the caretakers of that, to be the gardeners of the garden of your heart, and then to start working on it, figuring out healthy ways, appropriate ways, to shift how we are in this deeper way. And so, classically in Buddhism, one of the central points of Buddhist practice is not to have an experience of enlightenment, but rather to be a person who's transformed in such a way that they are seen as being enlightened. It's the personal transformation that's important, not the so-called, like, now I've attained the highest thing and I can put a badge on I can put on my resume, had that experience, checked it off. But rather, your resume can say, I was that way, and now I'm this kind of person. So, your inner life, your disposition, is, you know, something to be deeply caring for, connected to, or value. And I believe that everyone's inner life, their hearts, if we may call it that, is precious and valuable and well worth caring for and paying attention to, and yours as well. And it's a treasure that you have in there. And really no one else can be the gardener of your heart than for you. So may the weeds turn into... I'm trying to avoid saying flowers. That seems a little bit too sentimental or too something, but the weeds turn into non-weeds. So thank you all.